once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake McClure.
And the telephone numbers to call in here, if you're in, presuming that today is January 4th, 2014. Now, if it's some other day, you can still call the numbers. It's just that there will be a time warp issue. But if you're in the 254 area code and using a cell phone, you can call 254-773-1400 or a landline in East Bell County, 773-1400. Or
you can reach us also toll-free, 1-866-597-1400, anywhere else
within the sound of his voice.
Or your voice, either one of these.
Somebody's voice, which really is inaccurate. Within the reach of our radio signal, but not within the reach of our internet transmissions, because people in, like, Europe could get the internet transmission if they wanted it. It's all very complicated. Things used to be so simple. If you're in East Bell County, call 773-1400. But probably the majority of people listening to us right now, if they were going to call us, would use a cell phone. So that means that they would have to dial 254-773-1400. And it doesn't make any difference where they dial it from. It would be the same cost to them.
So I love that we are now giving directions on how to use area codes.
And we were saying, but this is the funny thing, I just said dial. I'm trying to remember the last time I dialed a phone. It was a long time ago. I used to, when I first started in the investment business, this is Jeff speaking, I did indeed dial telephones. I remember dialing telephones and how sore my finger would get because the preferred method of getting new clients for a stockbroker at the time was dialing for dollars, is what it was called. You cold called. And I, one night a week, I would sit down one evening, and I would not be able to, my manager would said I had to talk to 20 decision makers who would actually allow me to give my little pitch on the telephone before I could go home. And it was pure, unadulterated agony for me, and I'm just really glad I managed to get beyond that rather quickly. But dialing was the big deal. Of course, back then, you know what the sales pitch was? Do you remember what my original sales pitch was?
What was it?
First question.
I know.
What?
I know. Do you know what a mutual fund is?
Exactly. That was. Have you ever heard of a mutual fund? And they would say, "Why, no. What is a mutual fund?" And I got to explain to them what a mutual fund was. And that was our big sales thing, is we're going to go out and sell mutual funds because mutual funds are really cool. And
nobody knew what they were.
Right. And at that time, mutual funds had what we now call a front load of 8.5%. They were pretty uniform. That's what they had, 8.5% front load. And a new broker could make some reasonable quantity of money by getting people to invest in mutual funds, because it sure was a higher commission than we were getting on stocks or bonds. And the times have changed an awful lot, and we've come an awful long ways in the process. We are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and as I said, the first hour, we're both a fee-only registered investment advisory firm based out of Salado, where we give some objective fiduciary advice that we think works pretty well, and we got a lot of people who've been with us for two or three decades who seem to agree on that. And we're also this radio program, so you're welcome to give us a call. Let's see, we talked about how well the economy had done during the year, not the economy, but the market. There's a consensus out there among economists that I respect. And I respect, by the way, those economists who have very reasoned, careful approaches and are generally right when they make their forecasts, that we're going to see a much better economy in 2014 than we saw in 2013, barring some totally unexpected event, which is a little odd. And I think one of the reasons that that's going to happen is, and by the way, for whatever it's worth, it would be in the Republicans in Congress' best interest if they could slam the brakes on the economy this year. Because obviously people tend to vote for whoever's out of power, and the Democrats are perceived as being in power right now. When economic conditions are bad, people tend to vote for the party in power when economic conditions are good. So good economic conditions would tend to lead to improvements in the Democratic holdings, although there's some historic trends that run the other direction too. But the point is, apparently, at least according to the commentators I've heard, the leadership in the Republican Party has determined that shutting down the government and taking us to the fiscal cliff on a regular basis is not doing them a lot of good. So they're not going to do it anymore. We'll see if that works out. If that's true, we've removed one of the biggest risks to the economy. And if that's true, the momentum that we're seeing right now, right at the end of the year, we saw an increasing number of new house permits, new house starts. We're seeing hiring pick up. We're seeing layoffs fall off. And we're getting a very, very clear picture of a steady acceleration in economic growth. Not just economic growth, but that it's accelerating, and it's doing so not in a flash-in-the-pan surge, but in a very, very, very consistent manner. I still think it'll be 2016 before the economy is probably hitting on all cylinders and going great guns, which, again, does not bode particularly well for Republicans who are trying to run for office against the Democrats who would be considered to be in power, presuming they are at that point. But that's the way the economics appear to be working out. There's a lot of things going on in that area, and I'm kind of dominating here. You want to comment on that?
I'm following along, but I was doing some research into other areas while you were talking.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get over to George Soros, and he had some...
That's what I was expecting. This is the subject that I was looking around at.
George Soros had some interesting things to say about the economic aspects of the world today. He said that it appeared to him, the very thing I just mentioned, was in the process of happening, which is that the political risk to the economy would probably reduce over the next year. That's a good thing. He also noted that Europe was going to sink into the doldrums. It was going to sink into the stagnation that Japan has exhibited over the last 15 years or so.
Well, they've done the same sort of thing that Japan did during its crisis and are getting the same results. So, surprise, surprise.
They tried severe austerity.
Propped up the banks and then wouldn't let them fail, went to austerity and didn't overprop them, didn't get them to a point where they had reserves enough to make loans.
And he points out that the euro may destroy the European Union, in that not having a common treasury, not having euro bonds, but rather having each country running its own affairs and its own economics, but using a common currency, really put a severe divide between the haves and the have-nots in Europe. And there's the continual demand by Germany and the voters in Germany that the debtor countries pay back their debts. Now, that may sound a little bit odd. You know, of course they need to pay back their debts. Well, the fact is, in the United States, we didn't approach it that way. In the United States, the Federal Reserve has been buying up bonds, propping up bond prices to get rid of the bad bonds, taking control of them.
Right.
We have allowed, basically, we found a way to write off a lot of things, get the garbage behind us, and then begin to move forward. And we've been pumping a lot of money into the economy to do so.
Do you mind if I explain that just a moment? What the Federal Reserve has been doing in QE3 and QE2 and QE1, for that matter, all of its quantitative easing has been focused, if not primarily, then at least largely, in mortgage-backed securities. So most of you recall that when we had our downturn, it was led by the mortgage-backed security area. That area is what imploded. It actually started at AIG, which was insurance. on mortgage-backed securities, insurance on the defaulting and swapping of these mortgages. So when the Federal Reserve started buying them up, they weren't buying them up at the face value, the value that was at issue. They were buying it up at a big discount. So these banks that had purchased these mortgage-backed securities, they're holding them as reserves, but now the price of them has dropped so low that the banks who have a reserve requirement aren't able to give out any loans. Because the price on their reserve mortgage-backed securities dropped so low, they couldn't continue giving out loans. The regulation says if you give out more loans, then you have a certain amount of cash on hand. And if that cash on hand is not high enough, you can't give out more loans.
Yeah, and
which caused very healthy companies to go into severe trouble because they were using that loan system as cash flow. So what the Federal Reserve has been doing is going in and buying up from banks and from individuals these mortgage-backed securities that the value is so low. So the banks now have a reserve of cash rather than a reserve of mortgage-backed securities, at which point they can begin to give out these loans. There's some more certainty about what is cash going to be in a year than there was about what is a mortgage-backed security going to be in a year. And in the process, the Federal Reserve has made a pretty substantial profit, which is going back to the federal government. Anyway, that was some background.
He made an interesting point that in Europe, after reunification, the Germans have discovered a crushing burden.
Yes.
In their own country. And whereas previously the Germans were firmly in favor of a unified Europe, it becoming in effect one nation, that's now off the table. And instead, the Germans are insisting that everybody pay back their debts. Now, if the Germans had supported it, then the European Union could have issued euro bonds and replaced the bad debt of Greece and Spain. In, you know, basically, you can what they could have done is, yes, we'll insist on a degree of austerity. You give up the ability to set your own budget, but in return, we're going to take the debt off your books. And by the way, that's what happens in bankruptcy. When a family declares bankruptcy, many of their debts are forgiven, but their ability to borrow money is severely restricted, which means that they are forced to live within their means for an extended period of time.
Yeah, it's the credit score. And, basically, if somebody gives you a loan, it's going to be at a higher interest rate because you have a bankruptcy.
Or you won't even be able to get the loan.
Right, exactly.
So the point is, had that approach been taken, but if you force somebody into bankruptcy, give them a high interest rate, but then make them pay off all their debts, which means they don't have enough money to live on, what you will do is radicalize that family. And what the concern that George Soros brought up, and I think it's a legitimate concern.
I'm going to throw a piece of history in just a minute. It'll let you bring up George Soros' concern, legitimate concern.
Well, his concern is that the Germans are doing to the debtor countries in Southern Europe the same thing that the French did to the Germans at the end of World War One.
Right, that led to World War Two.
And George Soros is making a comment. He doesn't actually say this could. He said that Europe is in deep trouble, and here's the one thing that might rescue them. This is the amazing thing. He said, if Russia becomes aggressive, it could unite Europe and rescue them
right
from their own folly. Otherwise, the radicalization of the Southern European countries could literally lead to a war.
I'm going to bring in some history here about the place that first developed the idea of bankruptcy that we hold today in the United States. Across the world, it's held as an example. Basically, there's an expectation that you'll try to pay back some of your debt, but that you can't pay it back now. And that place, you'll like this. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm waiting.
Texas.
Ah, yes.
Texas, as a nation, not as a state, was founded. Its first president was bankrupt in Tennessee. Sam Houston was bankrupt. Davy Crockett was bankrupt. Bowie was bankrupt. The only founding father of Texas that I've been able to find that wasn't bankrupt somewhere. There was the first vice president who was from Mexico. He wasn't. But Stephen Austin was basically the financier, the only guy that had fluid cash.
And the Mexicans killed him.
And the so we've got this whole nation founded on the concept of you should be able to recover from the mistakes that you've made in the past. You should pay for them, but you should recover from it. And there was actually a very well-documented case. Texas was saying, come to us. We have no extradition treaty with the United States of America for debts. If you committed a murder, we'll extradite. If you left because the debtor's prison is chasing you, we're not going to extradite you. And when Texas became part of the nation, the Texas bankruptcy law trumps that of the rest of the United States in Texas. Now, the most recent bankruptcy law had some further restrictions on the way Texas does it. But the reason why I'm bringing this up is because look at Texas as a state. Look at the way we do business. We have a balanced budget for our government, and that's in the Constitution. We have no income tax, and that's in the Constitution. It was developed specifically because we, as a nation, were founded by bankrupt people. And we recognized that in order to not go bankrupt, we had to ease certain
things. We have no state income tax.
No state income tax, right. Yes. So
I think there's people in Texas who would like to say we have no income tax.
Right, that would be nice.
I think that's completely true.
But the United States as a whole has taken the idea that Texas had and slowly changed the law of the United States so that people didn't go to prison for debts anymore. There's only one debt you can go to, well, two debts you can go to prison for in the United States right now. Do you know what they are?
Internal revenue fraud.
Correct.
Fraudulent debt.
Fraudulent debt and this is even in Texas.
Child support?
Child support.
Yeah.
So those are the only two things you can still go to debtor's prison for. There used to be a prison just for people that were in debt, and they just sat there and worked until their debt was paid off, and that was considered to be pretty bad. Well, the rest of the world has now listened to what the United States has done, and the United States listened to what Texas had done. And every time we avoid using bankruptcy law in the way that I've just described, we run into cases like Japan or Europe. If we had forgiven the debt of Germany at the end of World War I, we would not have had a World War II. If in World War II, we did the Marshall Plan, which was a forgiveness of debt.
You know, the United States did not participate in that activity. I don't know if
correct.
You did it or not.
Correct. They didn't want the Treaty of Versailles. We did not. We had some pretty clear things we wanted going on, and they didn't happen.
We did not, the United States did not demand reparations for fighting World War I, but the French did.
And then they got conquered.
And the British did, I might add, too.
Yes. So the reason why I bring in this history, George Soros is from Hungary, a place that was conquered by the Soviet Union. Conquered in a very not overly bloody way, but the blood came later. So when he left and became a citizen of the world and a citizen of the United States, his concepts of capitalism are very strong. Now, they're much more aggressive than a lot of the United States capitalists would go to. But him making these statements about Europe and about China and about Russia, they come from a place where he's experienced it. And I am not a fan of his in a lot of the decisions he's made. He's made a very aggressive act, very profitable in many, many ways.
Well, he makes one of the things that he says in his article, and I think it's very accurate. He says, in contrast to Europe, which is entering a period of stagnation at best, division at worst, the United States is, and this is a direct quote from his article, The World Economy Shifting Challenges by George Soros. In contrast to Europe, the United States is emerging as the developed world's strongest economy. Shale energy has given the U.S. an important competitive advantage in manufacturing in general and in petrochemicals in particular. The banking and household sectors have made some progress in deleveraging. Quantitative easing has boosted asset values, and the housing market has improved, with construction lowering unemployment. The fiscal drag exerted by sequestration is also about to expire. And what he's saying is, we are set as a nation, and we are in fact kind of measurably right now, it's a short-term measure, but still, to be the fastest growing, strongest developed economy on the planet. Now, we're already the largest. We're quickly becoming the strongest. Now, this is the interesting part. We'll move on from there. And he talks about the fact that the positives of the fact that the Republican Party, both the Democrats and the Republicans at the extremes, have decided that being extremists is maybe not as profitable as they thought it was. Hopefully, we will continue in that direction. The major, as he says, the major uncertainty facing the world today is not the euro, but the future direction of China.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think anybody that takes a moment to look around will see that China is the second largest economy. It's following ours. Its population, just to give some concepts here, its population is so large that it as a country has the largest population of English speaking people for a country. So they have more English speakers that speak on a fluent level than the United States does, because it's so big.
Here's the problem. Here's what's going on in China. China has grown faster. And I say grown, not necessarily GDP, although that's been true too. It has raised the standard of living of the average Chinese person faster in a shorter period of time than any society in the history of the world. And I want to emphasize that the rate of growth of the standard of living in China has dramatically outperformed the very best that was ever done in the United States. Now, let's start with the understanding that the average household income in China was way below even the typical third world country when they started. So, but still, they have really developed since about 1978. They have been developing a model that will raise the standard of living very, very quickly, and they're focused on that, and they're focused on that with a laser-like focus. Now, here's the problem with that. In the process, internally in China, they have leveraged hard. There is debt, internal debt within their nation, that is also the highest in the world per capita. We don't hear a lot about that. Does that sound familiar? That's where the United States was. We had built up a tremendous internal debt in 2007, which turned around and bit us. Is that likely to happen to them? No, and here's why. The major institutions in China are owned by the government. The banking system is owned by the government. And when the People's Bank of China in 2012 started taking steps to curb the growth of debt because they saw a threat there, it's caused a slowdown in the growth in China. It caused a job drop off. The government stepped in and told them stop doing that. They again lowered interest rates, and they went back to using the equivalent of quantitative easing in China. Here's the problem. That has to end at some point. You can't just keep running internal debt up higher and higher and higher to pump the economy up. We are deleveraging internally in the United States and have been since 2009 and have done an amazing job.
Right.
Corporations have largely eliminated their debt.
A lot. The consumer debt has dropped drastically since 2009. So basically, we've been paying off our debt without austerity.
And
where in Europe, they're making more debt faster than they're paying it off because they're allocating more of their money, their budget, to paying off debt. And they're not building their cash reserves, so they every time there's an emergency, they've got to go more into debt.
And there's a problem coming in China, and the problem is they have to shift their emphasis, and it's going to be a big experiment to see how well they do this. In the United States, about 2/3 of our gross domestic product is personal consumption by individuals in the United States, the consumer, which has got to be the end result for long-term health in an economy. In China, it's 35%. they need to get their internal personal consumption up to about 67% to be healthy. The difficulty is they are running out of savings in China. And I mean this quite literally. They have their borrowing exceeds the savings at this point in the nation. And you think, well, yeah, it's kind of like us. Well, no, actually our savings exceed our borrowing here, largely because corporations have huge, just phenomenal cash reserves, and people are developing cash reserves so that inside the United States our savings exceed our borrowing. And then people think that's really crazy, we're a debtor country. Well, actually we're not. We are actually in pretty good shape. And we're going to get in a lot better shape if the economy does what I expect it to do this year and what the majority of economists expect, and which every indication is there that it will do. We will see significant growth in the United States economy in 2014 and probably in 2015. That's significant growth, that very significant growth. If we grow GDP at a nominal rate, as we did last year, folks, in the private sector of 6%, and I expect to see maybe 7% growth in private sector nominal growth this coming year. Here's the key. That means the revenues for taxes go up at about 8%. Now, you look at the amount of money that the United States takes in through taxation, and you grow it at 8%, and our debt problem becomes insignificant in just a few years. And I realize these numbers are higher than what you're hearing. I'm talking about nominal. It's very important to realize that our GDP next year, probably about 3%. That's the consensus. If we have 3% inflation, which I don't know that we're going to have, but if we have 2.5% inflation, then that means that the nominal growth in profitability in the United States is 5.5%. Well, whoopee-doo. Well, okay, here, why do I use nominal here? I use nominal because the tax codes don't index for inflation. When your income goes up, you pay more taxes. You don't get to say, my income went up 3% last year, and it wasn't. Let's say my income went up 2% last year. Inflation was 2%. So I get to take 2% off my taxes. No, it doesn't work that way. Our tax code is set up so that if we have a nice historic norm of 3% inflation, we all wind up with a tax increase of 3%, even if we are making the same buying power. Now, you may think that's unfair, but if you plug that in to the national debt, the real national debt, the debt that's outstanding, that people hold, that's called the public debt, you arrive very quickly at an astonishing conclusion. If we get our economy growing at a reasonable rate, and it looks like we're getting there very quickly and very relatively easily, our national debt will take care of itself and go away. Now, I realize there's a lot of things that could go wrong along the way. There's probably some other things we could do too, but we don't really have a problem there. We're focused on something that we really don't have a problem with. China, on the other hand, is going in the other direction. And that really leaves us in the, I hate to say this, but the catbird seat. The United States of America, and George Soros says this, and if you've been listening to us, I've been saying this since 2002 when I read an article in The Economist that got me to looking at this. The United States is going to so dominate the rest of the world for the rest of the 21st century that we will effectively become the world economy and the world government later in this century. And you can write that down and say, Jeff said this, is he right or wrong? If you look at where we are and where we're going, if you look at the fact that the Japanese were going to dominate us just a couple of decades ago, we were convinced the Japanese would be ruling the world. Right now, there's a lot of people who think the Chinese will be ruling the world. The Chinese demographics are completely reverse of that. So are the Japanese, so are the Europeans. And so if you look around the world and you see Where is future growth going to come from? Where is it occurring right now? Where is the innovation occurring right now? Where are driverless cars being developed? Where have we just, did the FAA just clear large swaths of airspace in
for driverless airplanes?
For driverless airplanes. I mean, we are the innovators of the world.
If you look at every tech company, and by tech company I mean new technology that's coming out, if you make a list of 500 of them and then you make a percentage of them that belong to Americans, you will soon find that you're talking about the high 90s in percentage. You're talking about 95 to 98% of those companies are American companies. When we look at Nobel Prize winning economists over the last several decades, you will find about the same percentage are American. The leading thoughts of our age come from our country. The leading technology, the leading thought, the leading medicine. And yes, I did say medicine. I'm talking about the fact that new innovations in the medical field happen in the United States, again, at about the same percentage rate. If you just subtract a couple of places like medical marijuana and take those into other countries, the rest of the new research taking place in medicine takes place in the United States, because pharmaceutical companies are allowed to keep the profits. They're allowed to pay back their own research prices. And when they have a patent on an item, they're able, yes, this is one of the things that I have a lot of trouble with liberals that say, you know, the cost of this pill that I just paid $10 for one pill, the cost of that pill was less than a nickel. And I have to tell them, you know how many decades of research went into making that pill only cost a nickel? We got to pay that back too, and they've got to have a profit, otherwise they're not going to keep researching.
Well, we're going to do some commercials here to help stimulate the economy, because Town Square has to pay the electric bill.
Yes.
And then for the toll-free telephone numbers that nobody's calling today.
Right. No, why would they?
Well, we had one.
I wouldn't call it.
Telephone number. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if today is the 14th or the 4th of Saturday.
The 4th of Saturday.
The 4th of Saturday, 2014.
January 4th.
It's actually the first Saturday in 2014.
It is 1414.
Wow. It's 1414.
1414.
So it's 1414.
No, I think it's 1414.
Okay, whatever. And you can give us a call, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back from these critical words from Town Square Media. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And presuming that today is January 4th, Saturday of the year 2014, you can give us a call in here at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And some very prescient person called before I even gave the number. So whoever it is on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I guess I'm psychic. What I wanted to address was your comment just before the commercial break about nobody calling in on the open lines. I'd like to tell you why I think that is.
Mm-hmm. They fall asleep listening to us.
Yeah.
All the traffic accidents we cause.
Yeah. Whenever you're in school or college, you don't interrupt the teacher or the professor. They know what they're talking about. You're there to learn.
Oh, that,
me,
that...
You are the professors of finance.
Well, now, but...
You are teaching us, and that's why most people listen, because you do a lot of research, and you know what you're talking about. They don't call in to voice their opinion. They call in to listen to you and what you have to impart to us.
Yeah, well, we love questions. I'm going to tell you.
Y'all are the professors of finance, as far as I'm concerned.
But we do love questions.
Yeah, one of the things that's different between us and generally teachers is that they have a curriculum. we're making it up.
They still know more than their students. That's why the students should listen to the professor and learn. That's what most of the people, I think, listening to you do. Oh. They listen to you and they learn from that.
Well, I hope so.
They make their own decisions toward investing and stuff like that. And like I said, to repeat myself, y'all are professors of finance.
Well, thank you. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing. We don't make a lot of noise about this. We don't really need to do this show. Consultants have told us that we really have no business doing this. we're wasting Saturdays.
Because we don't develop business from this program.
Well, rarely somebody.
Very rarely.
We have a few people who first heard the radio show years ago, our radio program years ago, and became clients. But we just right now we're in a pretty comfortable position. Our normal minimums are $1 million, and there's probably, other than our clients, there's probably not a whole lot of people listening who have over $1 million. And it's no longer, so it may have been at some point a source of business for our firm, but today it's far more, from our perspective at least, a giving back. We get a lot of compliments from people. We get some from our own clients, as a matter of fact, that they really appreciate what we're doing, and we have been blessed and are very fortunate in being in the position where we're able to not only support ourselves, but support, I think we got 10 employees now, and take care of them reasonably well and buy their health insurance, which is always an exciting thing to do. We have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Wait, hang on a minute. I can barely hear you. Say that again.
Okay. You said it again. You said give back.
Right.
What did you take to give back?
What? Say that again.
What did you take? You said you're doing this.
We receive a tremendous amount of money from the economy.
Yeah. And let me come in.
And
give
from
back.
People.
Give back doesn't necessarily that we had to take. We received, though. The idea of forgiveness, if you break that word down, for is in front of and giving. So basically when someone asks for forgiveness, they want you to forgive a debt. In the case of what we're doing here, there is no debt that we hold. But we do wish to share what we have with others. This is
yeah.
A really, really good way of putting it. I pay property taxes.
You do?
I do. I pay property taxes.
How dare you?
Shame on me.
Right.
I have no children. Property taxes.
Well, there's.
Go
maybe
to,
I need to explain to you the methodology one uses to relieve oneself of that deficit.
Right. I could have children. I don't have children, but I pay property taxes, so I'm paying for everybody else's child to go to school. Well, am I upset about that? Absolutely not, because I feel like. Education mm-hmm. is something that I am willing to invest in. If our society's education grows, then I will be bettered by it.
You know, there's something I wanted to bring up economically this hour that's another major trend, and being this is the first program of the year, I think it's a good time to bring it up. Over the last 20 years, there have been some very, very strong trends in the United States. And they are very consistent with regard to income. First off, if someone is in the upper 5% of the nation for annual income, was during that period, or is today, that group of people are seeing their income rise significantly year by year. They're doing very well. They're generally quite comfortable. But as soon as we drop below that 5%, we begin to see some other things. Of course, there's a group of people that are pretty much holding their own beneath that. But the middle class people who have jobs and they're working for a corporation and they're just doing their thing, this group of people, generally with college educations, is seeing a very interesting thing go on. Men's, over the last 20 years... the men in that group have seen the buying power of their wages drop 12%. That's a total of 12% over 20 years, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it can be. Now, the good news on the other side of that is the women in that group that are working have seen their income rise 16%. Does that quite equal out? Pretty close to it, because women got significantly less. We're making, so they're kind of holding their own in that area. So that's okay. But in the past, the middle group, the middle class, saw significant increases in value. Now, I want to emphasize something here. This is a necessity because of the fact that we're in a globally competitive world today, and that's really what's causing the issue. Now, here's where this bad news, sad news comes in. The, quote, blue-collar working class group of people, the people who are not in executive positions, who generally don't have college educations, have seen their income fall. And you know, I don't like this number, but it's there, about 30% in true terms over the last 20 years. So what does that mean? That means, by the way, that we need to take a hard look at this, because the last thing we want in the United States, and I know people say, well, you know, if they were just, I don't know. The bottom line to it is that as the economy changes and jobs are done by robots, it's not so much jobs going overseas anymore. It's jobs that are being automated or jobs that are being computerized. Like when you call a corporation today, a human being doesn't answer the phone anymore. There was used to be receptionist was the entry-level job.
Yeah,
receptionist,
if you think about
and or the mailroom.
The
okay?
phone bank. Yeah, the mailroom.
The mailroom. Well, the mailroom's now automated. You can't start in a corporation in the mailroom anymore because the mailroom, unless you're a highly skilled technician. So the mailroom, shoot, the mailroom is mostly internet. That's the IT department now.
Yeah.
But and even the IT department's getting farmed out. The point that I want to make is when we talk about giving back, one of the things that those of us who are better off, those of us who have earned and worked hard, it is in our best interest to try to educate those around us, to try to improve the outlook and the view and the education levels of all of society, because we exist based on the fact that a lot of people are spending a lot of money on a lot of things. And as a result, those of us who are fortunate enough to be in that upper 5%, and I am clearly in that upper 5%, as I think you are too.
Yes.
We're in the upper 5%. Now, we got there through hard work. We got there through taking a lot of risks. But at the same time, we cannot continue to grow in the United States and be healthy if we have an increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
I don't recommend giving them money. Don't misunderstand me.
Just give them the skills and give them
right.
the motivation.
And this is part of the giving back. The people who listen to this show, this program, hopefully will make a little better financial decisions. And when they make a little better financial decisions, the economy will become more healthy. And as the economy becomes more healthy, all of us become better off.
I mentioned George Soros and how I disagree with the way he goes about capitalism. He goes about capitalism where if he wins, somebody lost. It's kind of like sitting at a poker table. In order to win, other people at the table had to lose. Our mentality about capitalism is very different. I like the idea of true investment. Investment in relationships, investment in time, investment in money, where you become part of that which you're investing in. Where in order for you to make money, you have to provide things to other people that they deem worth the money. They want to pay for the service, and the only way long term for a society to function is for everybody to feel like they got the best end of the deal. If two people come into a trading relationship and one of them consistently feels like he's not getting a good deal or she's not getting a good deal, it's unlikely that that is going to be a long-term relationship. But if you think about every long-term relationship that you've sustained over decades, it's because you're getting, in your opinion, as much as you're giving or more. And in order for the other end of the relationship to feel the same way, they've got to have a different value set. Whatever it is that you feel like you're giving to it, they have to get a lot of value out of that. That's true in every respect. So when we say giving back to a relationship is what we're talking
yeah.
to. We're getting something out of our conversations with the world. And we want them to get something out of it as well.
And I think that's very, very important. Now, I want to end this. We're about out of time for the show. for the first the show.
We call the, it the show. First program first of program the year of 2014.
But I wanted to give you a little bit of background here. I'm going to talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average for a moment because the data available for the Dow Jones is so widespread and so easy to get, and it's easy to check on. And so I'm going to use that because it's a pretty good measure of what goes on in the market. It isn't perfect. I think the S&P 500 is better, and even larger measures are better than that, but that's all right. What I want to say is we're going to talk about the level of the Dow Jones Industrial Average minus dividends. And the reason I say minus dividends, we're not going to reinvest the dividends in these numbers I'm about to give you because that adjusts it very well for inflation. Dividends generally are about the same level as future inflation. So let's go back. When I started in the financial services business in 1982, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was breaking through 1,000 for the third time. The first time was in 1973. The beginning of 1973, at the end of 1972, the Dow Jones Industrial Average broke through 1,000.
Wait a minute, that was a long time ago.
Yes, it
was. Do you expect us to remember this stuff?
No.
This is a long time ago.
It took 20 years from the time the Dow broke through 1,000 for it to get to 4,000. Okay?
All right.
So in 1994, 20 years ago.
I remember this.
This is something critical. You can hang on to this. Now listen very carefully. The Dow Jones Industrial Average quadrupled in value in 20 years, 1973
to 94.
To 1994. Okay?
Now, 20 years later,
20 years
2014,
later, it's 16,000.
Quadrupled in value.
In 20 years. Every 20 years, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, after inflation, has been quadrupling. And by the way, if you want to go back in history before that, you find a very similar pattern. Not counting inflation. I mean, if you just discount the inflation here, because the dividends will make up for inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the stock market, quadruples every 20 years. That means it doesn't actually double every 10 years, but for the sake of reasoning, we will say that it does double every 10 years. That is effectively a 7.2% average annual rate of return.
After inflation.
After inflation in a dumb average.
Yeah.
And that's my forecast for the future.
I'm totally on board with that one.
Quadruple 16,000, and that's where we'll be in 20 years.
We're about out of time, so if you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting over the weekend locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 800-914-7526. You can also email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.